Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we, together, can make a positive influence in the world. Now, today, we're going to be talking about Dodging Dementia. It's a book that is based on the author's professional and personal experience of working with people with dementia and their families. It is written in a clear and accessible style with case studies and examples to illustrate the points. A book that is for anyone who wants to learn more about dementia and how to manage or, better yet, avoid it. Now, joining us from the UK is Mary Jordan, a director and founder of Adapt Dementia Limited. And through her books, trainings, and this interview, Mary shares crucial revelations about dementia. First and foremost to me is that it's not inevitable. Now, with new groundbreaking research, Dodging Dementia guides us through how to assess our personal risk or the risk of a loved one. Mary's ability to use her firsthand experience to illuminate points in the training makes her an inspirational and motivational trainer. Her specialist area is delivering cognitive stimulation therapy to those in early stage dementia. Mary, welcome to Answers Network.
Good to be here, Alan. Thank you very much for asking me.
Well, it is my pleasure. It is an area that I'm very interested in and have gotten much more interested in probably over the last 5 or 6 years. Now, I know that you have a personal experience in this area. So I think to start, why don't you share your experience and how it affected your choices to get so involved in this area?
Yes, okay. I had some personal experience because my mother-in-law developed dementia. That was my first experience, really, of any of it. And following that, I just became more interested, and I wrote my original book, which is called The Essential Carer's Guide. Then I had the opportunity to join a UK charity, which is Alzheimer's Society, and I'll always be grateful to them for the vast amount of training and experience they gave me. And through them, I just met so many people with dementia, so many carers, so many families. I then wanted to just really spread my experience.
Well, it seems as though it is something that has changed over the years. So share with us a little bit about what do we know about dementia now, and how has it changed either over the years that you've been looking at it or even before that as you were studying it and learning where it started and then and how we've gotten to the point we are now.
Yes, this is quite interesting because in some ways we don't know any more about dementia than we knew years and years ago. We still don't know what causes it. And dodging dementia is just talking about reducing your risk factors. We do know now far more about the risk factors, the factors that influence whether you will get dementia. But we can't pinpoint a cause. It's thought now that the causes are multifactorial and that, you know, a number of things in your life make you more at risk and then more likely to get dementia. We still don't really know.
Well, we have a question that came in, and I want to take this time to thank those people that take the time. I know that we have many teachers, we have many people that listen to or watch the show. And they watch it later on, so they're unable to either call in or to send in a message during the show. So they receive our press release, and we'll send in questions and ask that we can ask the question on the air, and then they'll listen later on. But this one, I think, goes right to what you were just talking about. This one reads, my mother passed away from a long bout with dementia. I've heard many medical influencers say that dementia is genetic. Others point to lifestyle. What is your belief on causation? And if much of it is lifestyle, what are the key lifestyle changes or interventions that can reduce the risk of developing dementia? And how can they be implemented in our daily life? And this is from Helen in Omaha, Nebraska.
That's one hell of a question, isn't it? Firstly, to deal with the genetic side, there is a genetic element to dementia. You can inherit certain genes that raise your risk of getting dementia. And depending on the variations of the genes you inherit, can raise your risk by up to 50%. But having said that, it's still not inevitable that you will get dementia. So we're just talking again about a raised risk. So it's a good question, because if you've got several relatives who've developed dementia, then it's worth thinking about that side of it. If it's just one, if it's just your mom, just your dad, a bit different.
Well, how about how much of lifestyle or diet gets weighed into this, and not even just from us, but let's say that we're looking at a relative that, that did have dementia, but their diet was that of many of us through the 70s, 80s, 90s, I know that from my standpoint, I mean, my mom thought it was perfectly reasonable, to give us the whatever sugary cereal we wanted from the cereal aisle, things like that. I know that my stepdad passed away from this, and he went through a period of time that I remember that, he loved iced tea, but he had the sweet tea, so there was a ton of sugar in that.
Sugar.
So do we look at the risk factors that they had, and does that change anything as we're weighing? In my case, it wouldn't be genetic because he was a stepfather, but for those that are, how do we weigh that with what their diet was, and then how do we reduce that by focusing on our diet or our lifestyle?
Interesting way of putting it. I wouldn't necessarily look at what the lifestyle was of the people who've had dementia. Okay. In comparison to now, I would look at the research that shows whether we can make changes to our diet now that would influence the possibility of getting dementia. I don't think it's probably rather difficult to compare your diet with diets in the past, because that just relies on hearsay. Mm-hmm. So on the whole, I can see your point. What you're trying to say is, if you look at the lifestyle of the people who've had dementia, who are your relatives, can we sort of make adjustments in that way? And yes, we can, to lifestyle points. Yes, we can. And that's generally covered. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about, let's talk about some of the myths and the misconceptions about dementia. And I know in your book, you debunk some of them. Share some of these and why you were able to debunk them.
Well, very common one is people saying use it or lose it. And there's truth in that. There's truth in that. But it's this, the idea that, in fact, I'll give you an example. One husband of one of my clients some time ago said to me, well, I don't think there can be much wrong with her because she can still beat me at Sudoku. And she was still able to do Sudoku for a long, long time, quite happily. But that just means that her brain had practiced doing Sudoku so much that she was really good at Sudoku. It didn't mean that she was developing her brain and exercising her brain. So I think one of the myths is this idea that if you do lots of crosswords, you're never going to get dementia. I think that's one of the ideas I might have debunked.
Yeah, and actually that was one of the things that I remembered reading, because it was one of the things that I've heard. I've heard that for as long as I can remember, you know. Yeah. And you know, I've got a brother-in-law that does the Sudoku, and he's like, well, I'm just making sure that I'm exercising the brain as well as the body.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good thing. It's not, I'm not suggesting it's a bad thing to do those things.
Yeah.
But if you do lots of crosswords, it will just make you better at doing crosswords. What you really need to do is new things to stretch your mind, stretch your brain. So it's a bit different.
Okay, well, that's a great point. So what I hear you saying is that, you know, do different things. You know, I read somewhere where someone had said, you know, if you never learn how to play a musical instrument, learn how to play a musical instrument, because it's an area that you haven't exercised in your brain. Yeah. And that kind of made sense to me. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a really good example, actually. We can't all learn to play a musical instrument, but right. it's a very good example, because you learning to play an instrument means that you use a different area of the brain, as he says, that has been lying neglected, really. But you can also do something like learn another language. You can make the effort to read books you wouldn't normally choose to read, to watch programs you wouldn't normally choose to watch, or films, to go to places you wouldn't choose to go. Just stretching your mind. I use the word stretching because the term is brain plasticity, mm-hmm. literally expanding and stretching your mind. And I think we can all do things like that. And it's hard to do. As you get older, you don't want to do new things. You want to go to the same grocery store. You want to stop at the same filling station. You don't choose to do new things. So I think that's a really worthwhile thing to think about.
Now, one of the things you talk about that I really liked in the book was confidence. Talk a little bit about how the book equips readers with sort of a newfound confidence in assessing theirs or their loved ones' risks. And talk about what some of the positive impacts that you have seen from people, either through, you know, through you working with them or just through them reading the book.
This is another very interesting question, because one of the things I find is that you can give people all the advice in China. You can tell them everything in the book. And really, really strangely, 50% of people won't do anything. So you're right. If you do anything, you're making a difference. But people need to have the confidence to do something, and not just to think, oh, it won't happen to me. Maybe it won't happen to me. I don't have to worry too much. I think it's making the effort.
Okay. So if you've got 50% of the people that are reading the book, but they're not really making any changes, what are some of the changes that are suggested that people are choosing not to do? Is this more from a diet standpoint, a lifestyle standpoint? What are you seeing?
One of the very important things, I think, is to check your medications, because there are medications that affect your cognition. And some of them are very common medications that doctors will just give out and are given to people. I'm not going to specify which ones, because that's in chapter 4, which is written by a doctor who's okay. very specific. But there are some medications that are given very commonly to older people that can affect your cognition. And I advise people, have a look at the evidence, go back to your doctor and talk about whether this is a good medicine for you to be taking. Nobody ever does. I think they're frightened to ask their doctor.
Well, if I can interject in that area, I believe I'm just the opposite, because I had a health problem. Now it's been 6-8 months ago, and they put me on 4 medications, and I felt great right after the operation. I felt wonderful. I was ready to go home. I said, I feel wonderful. Let's do this. And they said, no, no, you got to stay another night and we have to give you these prescriptions. So they gave me the prescriptions. After about a week of taking them, I felt terrible.
Terrible.
And I went to my cardiologist and said, this isn't working for me. And I did some of my own research. I'm a detective at heart. So, you know, I did my research and I gave him a list of more natural products that would do the same thing as the pharmaceuticals that he gave me. And he told me to quit asking questions, stay off the internet, that he's been doing this for 50 years and just do what I tell you. Mm. So that was the last time he was my doctor. I then went to the doctor that actually did the procedure, who was about 30 years younger, and went down and I showed him everything of my research. And he said, give me about a week to check all of this out. You've got a lot here. He says, let me check it out and then I'll get back to you. But in the meantime, stay on what the other doctor put you on. He went through all of it, came back to me and said, you're fine to make every change that you had. So there was a natural replacement for each one of those pharmaceuticals.
Wow.
I changed all of them and I went back to feeling myself again.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that you're touching on that. Are there some areas that you have found where there's a more natural replacement for a particular pharmaceutical drug that they're giving people?
Well, I'm very interested in herbal medicine myself, so yeah, I've often looked these things up. But again, I wouldn't like to commit to an individual, you know, like for like thing. But I think what you've done, it's a wonderful story, because what you've said is you did your research, you presented it to the expert, and you said, what about this? And he said, go away. That's just a great story, isn't it? Yeah. And then you went to another expert, more open-minded, ready to actually listen and look and learn. And the result is you're here. Look at you. You look wonderful.
Thank you. Well, I forgot where I was going to go after that.
I wonder a little bit if this is a particular UK phenomenon just because of our health service, that people don't like to question the doctor. I don't know that. You might find
That is a problem here in the States as well.
All right.
I'm hoping that it can shift, but yes, there are still a lot of people that just don't want to question them, which we could probably go in a whole nother direction and say, you know, that's why we had a bunch of people taking shots that, you know, without a whole lot of research or anything.
Oh, yes. Let's not go there. But
yeah, I know.
I'm with you on it.
What I'm saying is, you know, the US was as bad or worse than any other country with just accepting and taking it. So, well, actually, what I think I need to do, I'm going to take a break. But when we come back, I know in the book you give some examples, which I think is great. I think every book should, because I think it allows us, the reader, to be able to put ourselves in that position and understand it so much better. So when we come back, I wonder if you could give us a couple of examples of the growth that people have gained by making changes either in their diet or in their lifestyle, whatever it is. But let's talk about some of those examples that you give. So we're going to take a break right now. For everybody, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practice lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We're speaking with Mary Jordan, and we are talking about her new book, Dodging Dementia. When we went to break, I asked Mary if she could share with us some of the examples that are in the book on people that have really turned things around.
Yeah. Interesting, because I'd like to follow on from where we were just before the break
when
we were talking about medications, because right at the beginning of chapter four, Jerry Thompson, who's the doctor who wrote that chapter, gives a wonderful example of a chap who was on multiple medications and was really suffering from dementia symptoms, effectively. And when he came off these particular medications, he was back to normal. So there's a classic example there. That's about medication. And as I say, that wasn't my example. From my point of view, I think the biggest examples I have is when people who in the early stages of dementia often withdraw from society. They stop going to all their clubs and they stop meeting people because they don't feel they can keep up. They're worried that they're going to look stupid in conversation and things like that. And I have found that once I encourage them to get back into society, and one of the ways we do that is with the cognitive stimulation therapy, I've found some striking differences in people, in their confidence, once they realise that, you know, they're not going to be laughed at and they're not going to look stupid. And then they don't, because they get their confidence back and they're able to take part in society again. So I think that's quite an interesting example.
Yeah. Now, explain a little bit about what you do in the cognitive stimulation therapy that that helps them and that gives them more confidence in social settings.
Yeah, this is a therapy that was developed a few years ago. I was trained in it by a clinical psychologist. It's not a cure. We know there's no cure. But what it does is it just makes people more confident. It makes them more relaxed, more able to take part with other people and to feel that they're still living. People with dementia feel they're losing control of their lives, and they are. They are, because they can't manage things. This gives people back a kind of control in their lives. It's small group therapy. The groups are no more than 10 people, sometimes fewer. And I make sure that everybody is on a kind of a level. With dementia, there's difficulties for everybody. And I let people do the things they would like to do, comment on the news, discuss topics, do a bit of reminiscing, anything they want to do. But they're doing it within the group with a couple of facilitators who are totally, totally non-judgmental. They're there just to get people to enjoy what they're doing. And I have had really, really good feedback. I very seldom get anybody wanting to leave the groups. That the problem is I build up a waiting list because nobody wants to stop. And I've had people say that the person with dementia is better for days after attending the group. And the group's only 2 hours, so it shows you the benefit.
Wow, I like it. And I know that when we were talking in the beginning, you mentioned the nonprofit that you've worked with, the charitable organization, the Alzheimer's Society. Share a little bit about what kind of work that you do with them, and are there the same types of organizations throughout the world?
You have an Alzheimer's Society. It's not called Alzheimer's Society, but you have an Alzheimer's charity in the US. I don't work directly with Alzheimer's Society now, but I did work for them for several years in lots of positions. Best position was something called a dementia navigator, where I was effectively doing the kind of job I'm doing now, not the CST, but the other work, advising and giving people information and so on. And it was brilliant. I will always be grateful to Alzheimer's Society for the training and the experience they gave me.
Well, I was going to say it makes me think of something else, because I know that when I'm talking to people, if somebody mentions dementia or they mention Alzheimer's, they'll talk about it like it's two different things and share. I mean, I believe one is just a subset of the other, but share a little bit about that, that might clear up that those thoughts that people are having.
I'd really like to do that, because you're quite right. I've actually seen a post on a social media recently where somebody said, my wife's got Alzheimer's or dementia, the doctors can't decide which. and that, you know, I want to make this clear. You're dead right. Dementia is the name for the symptoms. So all the symptoms that people get, which is forgetfulness, loss of memory, difficulty in orientation, forgetting how to do things, those are the symptoms. And the name for those symptoms is dementia. Alzheimer's disease is a disease that causes those symptoms. So dementia is like an umbrella term for the whole lot. Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia, and there are, they reckon, more than 200 types of dementia. Oh. Yeah.
I had no idea there was that many. I know with my stepfather, they said it was, they called it Lewy body.
That's another type of dementia, and it's quite a nasty one, actually. Very difficult to manage. I expect you found that. It particularly affects often the visual problems. People often have hallucinations and things like that with that particular type of dementia and difficulty moving. It's akin to Parkinson's.
I was just going to ask that. That I'm surprised at times when people will talk about Parkinson's at the same time. And so, but it sounds like it is sort of a cross between, you know, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, something like that. Yeah.
It has elements of both. Yes.
So let's talk more about what can we do to dodge it. Let's dodge it. Let's dodge dementia.
Let's dodge the other. Okay.
So for everybody out there, get your pen and paper ready. These are some of the things we can do to dodge it.
Okay, there are a lot of things. What I've tried to do is explain to people a variety of things you can do, and then to allow you to assess really what you're prepared to do, because some things can be quite a big change to your lifestyle. If you wanted a really, really simple thing to do, it's what you touched on earlier, cut down on the amount of sugar you eat, and drastically cut the amount of sugar you eat. And look at labels, because there is sugar in the most unbelievable things. You'd be really surprised when you start to read labels on cans and packets. And akin to that is cutting down on highly processed food, which is another area really of nutrition. Aside from that, my personal feeling is that you don't want to go down any weird diet channels. You're talking about keeping a good, varied, mixed diet. Reduce sugar, reduce processed food, so fresh food. We can all do that, but we don't all want to.
Okay. Well, can we add organic in there as well, so that we reduce the intake of pesticides and such?
Always a good thing, because there's quite a lot of research showing, not so much showing pesticides with dementia, but certainly with Parkinson's, that's a very high level of research is showing there. But I think it's always good to cut down on that. So, yes, I agree with you.
Okay.
So that's as regards diet.
Second How about thing, exercise?
I was just going to come to that, so we're thinking alike. Exercise,
exactly.
Exercise is really, really important. And again, we talked about brain exercise earlier, but physical exercise for your body is more important because physical exercise is good for your health anyway. So if it's good for your heart, it's good for your brain. But also you're getting more oxygen to your brain. And when you exercise, we can go back to this, you're trying something new. So you can try a different form of exercise, or you can run down a different route than you did before. You can kill two birds with one stone, if you like. So, yeah, exercise. And don't stop. Just keep moving. Keep moving. Don't sit around. Get up and move around.
I like that. What about some of the other risk factors? Alcohol, pollution, smoking?
Yeah, smoking is one of the ones that is now considered really self-evident. I almost didn't have to write about it in the book. And pollution is another area heavily researched, but more difficult for us to control the risk. Because if you live near a busy road and you're getting polluted air, do you just move away? I don't know. But right. There's evidence there. I think you might be interested in a slightly unusual one, and that is uncorrected hearing loss. Very big risk factor for dementia.
Uncorrected hearing loss.
Yeah. In other words, not wearing your hearing aids when you need them.
Wow.
Yeah. Massive, okay. Massive risk factor. And I don't think many people realize that.
Well, there's another one now that is getting more attention. And I'm wondering if this is also a risk factor as we're talking about dementia, and that is EMFs.
Well, it's one of my hobby horses, and I could talk for a long time about that. But it's another area that I think nobody wants to hear about, because nobody wants to give up their cell phone. Nobody wants to switch off their Wi-Fi. And, you know, if you live near a radio mast, how do you move away? It's an area people don't want to talk about, but I'm a strong believer that it makes a huge difference.
Well, then let's talk about it.
I agree.
I don't care about the people that don't want to talk about it. You know, I want to talk about the things where we can make a difference. The whole idea is if we can make a positive difference by talking about something, then we're going to do it.
We're going to do it. Well, one thing you can do, everyone can do, switch off the Wi-Fi at night. So simple. Totally simple. Takes 2 minutes, switch it off, switch it on again in the morning. You save electricity as well.
There you go.
So that's something really simple, isn't it?
Yeah, simple. What about, and I've heard of this, I've not done it, but that there is some EMF blocking paints now that you can get like for your bedroom or something?
Yes, I've got a son who's very, very interested in this. So he's researched all this stuff. And there are these paints, yes. They're not always easy to source, and they're not always proven, and the colours are limited. But it could well be worth investigating something like that.
Okay. So now let's go into the kind of the simplest modifiable factors. Let's talk about sleep and stress reduction.
Well, sleep, it's now been verified that 7 hours minimum a night is really essential. There are loads and loads of ways you can improve your sleep experience, if you like. And one of them, going back to what we've just said, is to switch off your phone at night.
Mm-hmm.
And never, never, never sleep with it under your pillow. Do you know how many people do that?
I have to confess, when I was at the peak of my working time, I slept with it, not on under the pillow, but like right next to it.
Next to you.
It was in the bed. because the business that I was in, yeah. I would get calls in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And then once I got a little more knowledgeable, I put it further away. And now I put it in airplane mode rather than switch it off, because use it as an alarm. So I just put it in airplane mode.
Airplane mode. That's a very good compromise. Yeah. Yeah. I switch mine off at 9 o'clock at night. And anyone wants to contact me, they have to use the landline.
Well, for some of us, we don't have landlines anymore.
No, that's true. We won't have soon. That's true.
Yes. Now, you touched on something earlier that I loved, but we didn't really get a chance to stick with it. And that's the social interaction. You talked about how some of the people shut down. And one of the things that you're making sure that they do is continue that. Let's talk about how important that social interaction is.
Yes, it's a major factor for raising your risk of dementia. And this is a purely, some of the book, you know, my research is what I call subjective. It's what I have experienced. I can't prove it by research papers, but there has been to me massive evidence that the lack of social stimulation during COVID-19 really, really affected people badly. So people who were on the edge of dementia developed it. People who had dementia got worse. And that is subjective, but I meet dozens of people with dementia every day, and that's what I've seen. I think it was the worst possible thing that could have been done to people. So that's one element.
Yeah.
It can be hard to get people who've got dementia to keep socializing because they find it hard. One thing they can't do is initiate meetings and things. So you do have to have a really good carer, companion, partner, whoever it is, who will help you with that. But when you've got someone who helps you, and when you can keep up your social life, it makes a marked difference. And clubs these days, things like Rotary, you have Rotary over there, don't you? Those kind of clubs, they're so much more tolerant these days. And they will accept if you come out and say, look, I've got a memory problem. You know, that people will make adjustments so that you can continue to attend meetings and things like that. I think you have to be upfront and ask for help.
Yeah, and I think part of the message here isn't just to those people that may be starting to go through some of these things, but let's talk directly to the friends. If you have a friend that's starting to do these things and they're starting to be more forgetful or things like that, don't let them shut you out. Be that aggressive one that goes, no, you are coming. I'm picking you up.
I'm picking you up. Yeah. Let me help. Let me take you. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. People don't want to accept help, but you need to be offering it and making that effort. You're right.
Yeah. And, you know, be that kind of friend that you've earned the right to be able to talk to them like that.
Yeah. More of a friend than they know.
Yes. Well, Ed, we're going to take another break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about being a foreign correspondent, I think in 40 countries and things like that. I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple of those stories. So again, for everybody out there, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. Westshield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. Westshield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child, This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. Westshield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step.
And we're back. We are talking about dodging dementia. So if anybody has thought about that, if you have a loved one, this book, again, called Dodging Dementia, really goes into sharing a lot of stories and provides provides a almost like a pathway of things that you can do to be able to dodge dementia. Yes. Well, I mean, everything that we've talked about, some of them, like you said, a lot of people, you can tell them and they don't do it, but it doesn't mean that it's, that we shouldn't know it, we shouldn't be aware of it. Yeah. We can't make it, it's what's the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. Okay. Yeah. But for all the other ones that were smart enough to drink, you helped them.
They're still alive. Yeah.
So when we went to break, I asked you a little bit about the fact that, you talk about the fact that you've been a foreign correspondent, I think it was for about 14 years, and that you were writing while you were in these countries, I think up to like 40 countries. So what are some of the most memorable stories or experiences that you've had in this very interesting career?
I'd love to know, because I think you've muddled my bio up with someone else's.
Oh, my God. I think someone said something. Okay, then.
But I can tell you why I've chosen to write.
Yes.
About what I do, mm-hmm. which perhaps is the same thing you're asking, effectively.
Yes.
This is because working one-to-one with people in Alzheimer's society, I realise how sometimes just one little thing you said to people made a massive difference. And I thought, I'm reaching 40 or 50 people here. That was my client base. Mm-hmm. If I write a book, I can reach mega numbers of people. Yep. And that's really what set me off. So, and fortunately, I enjoy writing, so it's not a chore. But by writing, you can reach so many more people.
Well, let's talk a little bit. I know that you have more books than just Dodging Dementia. Share with us a little bit about the other books, because it seemed like they sort of led up to this one.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. The very first book in this in this subject, if you like, that I wrote was The Essential Carer's Guide, which I wrote after my experience looking after my mother-in-law. And I then have written a series of books on various aspects of dementia, but also on end-of-life care and of bereavement, because that's a big factor.
Right.
Because, we've got to face the fact that dementia is a terminal disease. So it's all part and parcel of life. So I've written a number of books about caring, a number of books about end of life and bereavement. And the book immediately before this was about mild cognitive impairment, And then this book is hopefully showing how you can avoid all these things or dodge them, particularly with reference to mild cognitive impairment, because that's when people are diagnosed with that. That's often when they start to think, oh, but I don't want this to progress to dementia.
Right.
So that's the time when people often start to think about it seriously.
Well, and I we've only got a couple of minutes, but what would be one piece of advice that you would give to other caregivers? I know you were a caregiver, so not only have you written a book about it, but you went through that aspect of it as well. What's that one piece of advice you would give those who are currently looking after someone with dementia or see that they're going to be doing this very soon?
Yes, you might be surprised about the piece of advice that I'm going to give, but it is accept help. But none of us want, we all want to be independent. We can manage, thank you. Well, we don't need any help, thank you. But when you've got dementia, you do need help. Accept help. Any help that's offered, and ask for help. That would be a key piece of advice.
Right. So, and what you're saying is that even as the caregiver, so it sounds like what you're saying is that there's potentially a problem that when you become the caregiver and you're not accepting help, you're just so focused, your tunnel vision on them, and you're probably not doing them as much good as you could, as well as not really taking care of yourself. Is that kind of
really well put. So dementia puts a huge stress on the caregiver. It's almost impossible for somebody who hasn't done it to understand the level of stress that a caregiver is under, because it's 24/7. And yes, you're right. You're going to damage yourself. You're not going to be able to give the best care to the person you're caring for. And all you have to do is accept help. It's a hard thing to do, actually. But the number of people who, when they have done it, followed some advice I've given and done that, have said, I realise now, I should have done this ages ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a small thing, small piece of advice.
Well, if they're going to ask for advice, is one of the place to look for advice, obviously, is in your book. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way? Is there information on your website, or what is the best way?
Yeah, there is information and contact details on my website. I am not at the moment insured to accept one-to-one clients in the States, but if someone in the States wants to help me in that direction, I'm very happy to extend my client base. But people can certainly contact me.
Okay. But this show, we get people that call in from all over the world. So we could get people, we could get people in Europe as well.
Yeah.
That would be listening that might want to get in touch with you.
Yeah.
Go ahead and give us the website.
Yeah, it's very, very simple. It's the www, of course, and then it's Adapt Dementia, all one word, adaptdementia.com.
Adaptdementia.com. For those of you that are driving, don't worry, we'll put this in the notes. Don't feel like you have to do anything. So, Mary, thank you so much. And again, not just for coming on the show, but for writing a book, and for really making a positive difference in the lives of others.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed this interview. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care. And for everybody out there, be with us next week when we are joined by the author of An Unapologetic Spinster. And I'll leave what that's about to your imagination. So everybody, please visit our archives of past interviews at Answers Network. Or just subscribe to the show. You can do it through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It'll help us reach more people, and I want you to know we greatly appreciate it. And the next time you're on Facebook, X, or Twitter, I know Facebook is, or X is Twitter, Instagram, Please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like what we are posting, if you like our shows, please like us and spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.